and stoicism, it's just, both of them are responses to the pathos, responses to passion. Essentially, the Epicureans are just saying, give in to your passions and be kind of one with them to some degree, and then it's a vast oversimplification. And the Stoics are like, no, you have to control your passions, and being in control of them is what life is all about. And then the skeptics kind of are just like, don't bother about this. Just like, knowledge, you can't know anything for certain about passions. Just, live your life and you'll figure it out as you go along. So, I mean, I kind of understand those first three. It seems like they make sense from my very limited basic understanding. The Neo-Pythagoreans and the Neoplatonists, they seem a little bit harder, but I guess that's because they're drawing on a longer and also a more religious and mystical tradition.
Yeah, to get in it specifically, I mean, because we're using the term neo here to mean new emergences of these are inherently historical because they emerge as revivals of certain schools. To do that, we'd have to get into the particularities of, well, people feel a certain need for bringing back these schools. What do they need with that? In terms of, I mean, with Plotinus, it's a transcendental unifying principle in a Christian context, an emerging Christian context. Yeah, you have certain demands that are made on schools, and they go looking for ideas, and some of the ideas still hold weight, and they make a comeback, as it were. I mean, Stoicism and Epicureanism and skepticism, all kind of being reactions to the academic Platonism of the time. But then you have, the people who still see potential in that and who find new contexts to apply it in.
Yes, I just want to remind our listeners that you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and today's episode is our third episode in a mini series on the history of Western philosophy, covering the Hellenistic and Roman period in that larger history of Western philosophy. If you're not familiar with the word Hellenistic, that's just another word for Greek. So ancient Greek and Roman philosophy is what we're talking about today, after the deaths of the grand trio, the first three philosophers, or the first three great philosophers, although there are many, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, who we've covered on the first two episodes of this series. So I did want to mention very briefly that Aristotle, after he died, Aristotle had several students who carried on his work, and they made a lot of preliminary investigations building on top of his work and his methods in the field of medicine, in the field of physics, and in some other fields. So what we in the West would consider proto-scientific investigations, or very, very early investigations into what we consider today scientific phenomena. Aristotle is kind of the progenitor of, you could say, the scientific method. And later in the medieval period, Aristotle's lectures are rediscovered, and that is part of what creates the new movements in medieval philosophy, which will eventually lead to the Enlightenment and the scientific period. Okay, but getting back into the topic of today, we are not going to skip over the importance of what we've been talking about. Let's talk a little bit more about Stoicism, particularly the social and political context. Because on this show, we talk quite a bit about the origins of political thought. We've had some discussions on artificial intelligence and democracy. I think there's an upcoming show drawing on some of Hannah Arendt's work on the origins of totalitarianism. So when it comes to a philosophy of politics, what developments are we seeing in the ancient world? Well, at this point, we have seen the ending of the city-states period, the polis period in ancient Greece. So this is famously the time when Athens and Sparta have a war and have a ritualistic dance for dominance in terms of which one of them has the most Greek or the correct Greek philosophy of life, Greek philosophy of government. Athens is more or less the last man standing in that, and which is why we get the majority of our thinking from Athens and not Sparta. Although Sparta's thinking was heavily militaristic, whereas Athens was known for being a merchant hub and a trade hub. It's also worth noting, because this is important, that it was essentially a center for slavery, that slavery was practiced quite often there. In fact, Solon, who was an Athenian merchant, who was someone who drafted the first constitution of Athens, he has to create a law forbidding people to lose their Athenian citizenship to debt, and that debt, and the result of not being able to pay your debts, being sold into slavery. So that there were actually very rich citizens of Athens who were taking other citizens and making them slaves. So the reason I bring this up is because I see this as a being a really big problem with Stoicism and Epicureanism, is that they don't address fundamental things such as slavery. They are essentially philosophies of the rich or the powerful or the self-sufficient. And that, I think, is problematic, honestly, for a broader understanding of society and political life. So would you like to speak into that a little bit, Brandon?
Yeah, I think it's, I find it interesting that you say that it's kind of a philosophy for the rich, and in an important way it is. It's for the rich and privileged and of a particular temperament, I suppose, that would be conducive of living a certain life in the world that they're living in. You know, someone with the will to survive, basically, which is where we get this notion of, we have this popular philosophical conception of the Stoic, the stone-faced person who can just bear it all. But I find it interesting that you kind of give it a class association, because I think you're thinking specifically about Marcus Aurelius, who was head of the Roman state at the time. But importantly, Epictetus, who is another huge name in Stoicism, was himself a slave. And it's interesting, this never gets failed to be mentioned, that Marcus Aurelius derives a lot of his thought from, or he's borrowing from and learning from Epictetus. The emperor has learned from the slave in a way. I think you're right that in a certain sense, it's still kind of for the rich. It's for people of a certain psychic configuration. But Epictetus does say, like, you have to train yourself to do this. There's a certain eskesis, a certain training, a certain exercise, a self-sculpting that you have to go through. You have to do this. You have to learn to manage impressions, manage expectations, and whatnot. Certain people have it easier than others. I'm sure a slave would have a very difficult time constantly bumping up against things that are not within their power. In fact, almost nothing seems within their power. But then comes Epictetus, ostensibly a slave, who says, actually, there's plenty of things that are in my power. You just kind of have to look for them. And by the way, everything that isn't in my power is entirely indifferent anyway. So I think the Stoic response, if I was to take it seriously and maybe a little tactlessly, would be to say, well, that's actually entirely the point, is it's a response to this situation. You have people falling into troubles. You have nations collapsing around you. It's a bad time. When I was taught Hellenistic philosophy, I was given the contextualizing, I guess, metaphor, or it's a geometrical ratio of saying that the Hellenistic period is to the golden age of philosophy, you know, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. So the Hellenistic period is to that what modernism is to the Enlightenment. In the Enlightenment, you have this explosion of incredible philosophy. You have, well, Descartes is kind of at the beginning of it. He's more in the Age of Reason and the Scientific Revolution, but he does participate in the Enlightenment. You have Kant offering the critique of pure reason and kind of synthesizing realism and idealism. You have Hegel positing the absolute, and all of this incredible world-changing philosophy emerging. And then you have modernism as the kind of consequence or fallout of that. Yeah, and you have people like Nietzsche diagnosing modernism as a kind of problem and even, you know, an illness in a way. People have to cope with the effects of the Enlightenment in a certain way. I don't know if that analogy holds up so much, that in the Hellenistic period, people are coping with the damage done in the golden age of Greek philosophy. People tend to look at that as the beginning of the upsurge in a way, but people are living in dire circumstances. Things are falling around them politically. Absolutely. So maybe there's a breakdown in that analogy there, but I do think it's an enlightening comparison.
The Roman state is the very first of its kind in world history. They intentionally construct it in such a way that there are balances of power. There is the plebeian assembly, which is supposed to be democratic in nature. There is the Senate, which is supposed to be oligarchical in nature, which is run by the landowners. And then originally in the Roman Republic, there are two consuls who reign over basically the other assemblies. They're the executive branch of government. And so our modern idea of representative democracy, it's of course not a one-to-one comparison, but there is a developmental progression in governmental systems. And the Roman Republic is a very important part of that, where we have a first house of representatives, a second house of representatives, and an executive branch of government over that, just as was later developed in the Isle of Britain, and of course was then exported to the United States and many other nations who were British colonies. So Rome is incredibly important from the political perspective in that sense. And because of that, the writings of Marcus Aurelius as a Roman Empire, I mean, there's this famous saying today that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And Marcus Aurelius is really the example of that not being the case. He, out of the long history of Roman emperors, some of which are incredibly, you could say, immoral people, especially from the philosophical perspective. If you look at Nero, someone who indulges in every sort of thing, he's famous for having a group of friends who he goes around Rome at night and just steals stuff as the emperor. So there's, if you juxtapose that with Marcus Aurelius, someone who holds himself to the highest moral standards and, yes, literally takes advice on how to be emperor from a slave and puts essentially his own self-sufficiency as a human being first, with the pursuit of virtue and the pursuit of living according to nature first, above the pursuit of wealth, above the pursuit of power, above the pursuit of pleasure. That is something that, because we live in a time period where human nature hasn't changed all that much, and there are still people who are in political life who are drawn to power, who are drawn to pleasure, who are drawn to these pathoses, to go back to our original discussion, the ideal of Stoicism and the dogmatism of that, of saying that you need to be in control of yourself and to be at one with nature, at one with yourself, I think that's very, it's becoming very attractive in the modern day. But I'm not sure, I guess what I'm getting to here is that we're basically seeing the beginning of a movement of, I would call, like a neo Stoicism almost, because it's a reemergence of Stoicism, but it's not really for the same reasons and for the same context as ancient Rome. There are a lot of differences. So I'll stop there and let Brandon comment, and we'll see where we go from here.
I had a classmate once who commented on when the professor said Marcus Aurelius was an emperor kind of at the beginning of the decline of Rome. He said, I wonder why that is. You know, I mean, I think about the Thucydidean line that people know the kind of small bit of it, the strong do what they please while the weak suffer what they must. But there's an important qualifier to that at the beginning, that this is a perspective taken by pragmaticoi, by practical people, people concerned with the affairs of the world. I mean, by doing Stoicism in a way, it's inherently kind of a retreat. Marcus Aurelius talks about the inner citadel that one retreats into in order to contemplate and to sort out one's affairs. Is he still doing that as a pragmaticoi, as someone concerned with the world? I think so, yes. But he's going about being a pragmaticoi in a very, very different way than most Roman political agents would have done that. And I don't know. I think it's a funny quip. I think it's an interesting kind of insight, but I don't know how true it is to say that, Marcus Aurelius was a bad emperor. Well, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. He was certainly, and, you know, in my interest, because I'm interested in philosophy, he was a philosopher emperor. So that was very interesting. I would be interested to, and you know, this is the, have to go look into the history of it. I would be interested to see how efficacious he was as an emperor. I'm sure he was fine. You know, Rome didn't fall immediately after him. But in any case, you're absolutely right. It's interesting that this emperor is, things have kind of been turned on their heads in a way, in this sense.
One of the things that Marcus Aurelius is most criticized for is his persecution of Christians. He pursued a policy which was quite anti-Christian, and that did not endear him to later thinkers, especially medieval thinkers, who were by and large Christians because of the nature of medieval Europe and the nature of philosophy at that time. Something that we'll get into later on next shows is that essentially philosophy only survives in Europe because of certain Christian monasteries. And then later those monasteries become part of a program called the cathedral schools, which mainly starts in France. And then those cathedral schools eventually develop into universities. Marcus Aurelius's stance on Christianity, I remember we were having a little bit of a debate among some of the people on the Canadian Philosophy Show on if an artist is kind of a bad person, does that mean that their art must also necessarily be bad? And you can ask the same thing of philosophy. If someone is a bad person, is their philosophy necessarily bad? And I think for a lot of people, that's just intuitively obvious, and that's the case. And it's one of those things where you look at some philosophers, you look at some people like Marcus Aurelius, and it's very easy, I think, for some people to say like, well, you know, he did these types of evil things, therefore he was an evil person, therefore we should just, you know, disregard all of his philosophy. Now, from my perspective, as someone who took one course in world history, I think that's a mistake. Because when you study world history, you realize there are only so many surviving historical texts, and we need to learn, I think, everything we can from those historical texts, regardless of who wrote them, otherwise we won't have anything of history. And I think it's very, very, very difficult to, if you start with a strict set of moral precepts of, you know, this person who did this was good, I'll read him. This person who was not good, I won't read him. If you start with that type of perspective, I think you'll end up with a very strange intellectual development, because it's very hard to, I think, wrestle with, well, the ethical questions if you've already made up all of your mind about a lot of these same questions.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good sort of side tangent, I guess, to bring in. I mean, the one thing that I've learned is that philosophy is kind of an exercise in impartiality and judgment in that way. It would be really difficult to study philosophy if, before you did so, you go and check the character of each person. Now, maybe it depends on certain philosophies, like say you wanted to study virtue ethics. Well, virtue ethicists take moral exemplars, and so you would want to assess whether they're a good or bad person. You'll go and observe them. But you're doing that for a philosophical reason at that point. You're doing that to cultivate a sort of character by examining this person. And you can also kind of bracket certain things. I mean, Marcus Aurelius did this terrible thing of persecuting Christians. Well, now you know, oh, well, that was his character flaw. I'm going to still take him as my model, but he's my model. I'm not going to persecute Christians. I'm going to do all the other helpful Stoic things that he did, like meditate upon his mortality and his duties and, you know, discern what is and is not in his power and remain humble by, you know, taking lessons from a slave and whatnot. You can kind of, you have a little bit, I don't want to say like you have leeway with these things. I think the things get thorny when we get to these unqualified sorts of like, is a person completely irredeemable? Is it like soaked all the way through and whatnot? You know, think about like fascist dictators and whatnot, people who are, what we would call in philosophy, radically evil. There is no light in them or anything like that. I mean, I wouldn't blame anyone for not wanting to engage with them. It's not, it's kind of like we would think, you know, if you can find something in them that's good, that's, well, first of all, we'd all be shocked because we thought there was nothing good. And it would be, we would take their claims very, well, I don't know if we would take them seriously. We would be very skeptical of them, but they would need some very good reasons for saying, oh, actually, you know, but I'm getting a bit of field because Marcus Aurelius, even if he is like a bad person and did bad things, he's actually a pretty tame exercise in impartiality. You know, the things he was known for are quite isolatable, and you have a text that you can kind of contain yourself to, especially in philosophy. It's very easy to just read the text, and if there is something beyond the text that interferes with that, well, maybe consider that. But a good exercise of impartiality and just a good exercise of reading philosophy is sticking to the text, kind of remaining internally consistent and taking people seriously how they express themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of really valuable insights. I think it's very easy to, when you start analyzing a text or a school of philosophy, to come at it with your prior understanding. And so when you read a few sentences and you're just like, well, that's just wrong. And you read another few sentences and you're like, well, that's just wrong. And you read a few more sentences and like, oh, I already agree with, and that's right. But I mean, that's not how, academically speaking, you're supposed to think about things. Like, you don't think about it in terms of a few quotable sentences. You think about it in terms of paragraphs and chapters and the overall theme of the work when you analyze their ideas. And I think if you want to give a fair evaluation to philosophical ideas, you have to spend a deeper amount of time investigating them. And I know that that's really silly for me to say as someone who isn't educated in philosophy and is talking about philosophy on a radio program and is reading an article from Encyclopedia Britannica. So I have obviously not deeply engaged with all of these works that we're talking about on this show. But that's not the purpose of this show, because we can only cover so much in so much time. The purpose of this show is to get our listeners, get their foot in the door, and become aware and awake that they can go and investigate these things for themselves and to guide them a little bit in those first investigations. So I think we're about out of time for today. I was hoping to get a little bit more into Epicureanism, a little bit more into skepticism, but I think we've done a fairly good job of showing some of the development of ideas in the history of Western philosophy and just giving people a vocabulary. All right. Do you have any closing thoughts, Brandon, before we end the show?
I think that the scope of your project is actually quite sound. Even, you know, at least you're honest about your training, and that not to like rag on you or anything, but yeah, we're kind of doing a cursory reading of the history of Western philosophy. And I should say, actually, I think it's very helpful. So when I started studying philosophy, the first textbook I read was, and I'm kind of air quoting textbook, I guess it's a textbook, it was that yellow and red The Philosophy book. And it's kind of like pop philosophy, it's not very deep or anything like that, but I got infinite value from it because, and I still recommend it to people who want to read the history of philosophy first before they dive into anything deeper like Anthony Kenny's A New History of Western Philosophy. Read The Philosophy book first because you get all your ducks in a row. You learn that, oh, Kant comes after Hume. Oh, Hegel comes after Kant. Oh, you know, Plato roughly thought this. You know, it's just, you figure out where people are kind of are in this long and great story. And also it has some Eastern examples too, which is nice. But yeah, as a cursory first step in the door, even if you learn the kind of milieu or you get the general feeling for it, if you learn in this era, this person was writing and whatnot. And I think in a sense, even if that's all you achieve, Aaron, I mean, there's a little bit more substance to it. We're talking a little bit about the doctrines and we are thinking about these things, which it's actually very difficult to do with that book. It's very just, here's what's going on. It's difficult to assess those things. So this is a good platform for that. So I definitely recommend your mini series over the philosophy book. Don't worry. I like to call it the Fisher Price History of Philosophy because it looks like a toy. But in any case, I think even for the first time, I guess, learner of a history of Western philosophy or any philosophy for that matter, even a cursory glance at who goes where, what eras are there, what's going on and whatnot, I think that puts you in a better position than people who haven't. Well, obviously, knowing things is good, but it's a very powerful thing to understand the circumstances that things are going on in, the order that things are going on in, just generally grafting the history of philosophy to your general knowledge of history, of world history in general. I think it's a useful exercise, and it rewards the philosopher in heaps.
Thank you for that encouragement, Brandon. I think that we are out of time for today. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I certainly have, and feel free we have a new email address actually. If you have any comments on the show, things we can do better, things you would like us to talk about, you can email us at hellotcps@gmail.com. Again, that's hellotcps@gmail.com. So I hope everyone has a wonderful rest of your day, and you'll hear from us in the next episode. The Canadian Philosophy Show is now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Go ahead and check out our archives. Just search for The Canadian Philosophy Show and we should show up.
This is Bird Note. In the tropical forest of Trinidad, a male bearded bellbird sings from within the tree canopy. The male, nearly a foot long, is a chunky white bird with a dark head. He appears to have a dark beard of long whiskers hanging below his wide beak. It's a peculiar mess of rubbery-looking feathers. But that metronome-like chirping is just one of his songs. He's known for a sharp crack that's shockingly loud. Hidden in the canopy, males cannot see one another as they sing, but they sure can hear each other. Their ear-splitting songs carry over long distances. One of four South American bellbird species, the bearded bellbird, occurs across much of northern South America. The loudest of the four is the white bellbird, reaching an ear-splitting 125 decibels, louder than a rock concert. It's the loudest bird song ever documented. Now that's a bird that turns it up to 11. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Note is provided by Jay Bruce and Alice Wheelahan from Washington, D.C., and generous listeners around the world.